Hello and welcome to Pathways, where you are invited to join me for a visit with leaders in personal development and cultural evolution. This is your host, Paul O'Brien. Conflict. These days we are consumed with conflicts in our personal lives, in our work lives, in our world. Whether you face an upset spouse, a confrontation on social media, an unhappy customer at work, or an unresponsive teenager, how well do you handle it? Does the argument intensify because of their responses? Can habitual responses of anger and frustration be circumvented so that cooler heads can prevail? Today's guest says, or provides a simple, surefire way to communicate with others respectfully and productively, no matter how tense a situation may be. Our guest is Doug Knoll, author of the new book, Deescalate: How to Calm an Angry Person in 90 Seconds or Less. Doug is a lawyer turned peacemaker. He is a teacher, speaker, and trainer, and the award-winning author of three books, one of which we discussed 5 years ago on Pathways, named Elusive Peace. A co-founder of the Prison of Peace nonprofit service organization, Doug's vocation is to serve humanity, and he executes this calling on many levels. Using pragmatic and practical skills of peacemaking, he helps people resolve deep interpersonal and ideological conflicts. Hello, Doug, and welcome back to the Pathways Show.
Paul, it's hard to believe that it's been 5 years, but it's really great to be talking to you again.
And it's really gratifying to see how your work has evolved over the last 5 years by comparing your new book with the last one. But before we get into that, let's just talk about your evolution from being a lawyer to becoming a peacemaker, because to a lot of us, that sounds like quite a turnaround.
Well, people think of lawyer to peacemaker, it sounds like an oxymoron. But the truth is that lawyers have been peacemakers for as long as there have been lawyers. The shoulders that I stand on are the shoulders of Abraham Lincoln and Mohandas Gandhi, both of whom were prominent peacemakers in their time. And so I like to think that I am, in my own humble way, just following in their footsteps. What got me into peacemaking from being a hardcore trial lawyer was an evolution that took about 10 years, really starting with my martial arts training, that led me into Tai Chi, that led me to begin to question whether or not I was serving my clients and humanity best as a lawyer. And ultimately, I decided to try something different. So I went back to school and got my master's degree in peacemaking and conflict studies, being trained by the Mennonites, which is one of the traditional Protestant peace churches. And they opened my eyes and mind to the complexity of human conflict and revealed to me how the law is not adequate for dealing with many kinds of conflicts. It is very good at resolving certain kinds of conflicts, but it's very poor at resolving other kinds of conflicts. So I decided to leave the practice of law. I left a very successful trial practice in 2000 and became a peacemaker. And that's what I've been doing ever since. I don't make nearly as much money as I made as a lawyer, but I help more people in a month than I helped, you know, in 22 years as a lawyer. So I'm quite satisfied and gratified and very blessed to be doing what I'm doing today.
You know, you talk about the limitations of the law in terms of resolving conflicts, and you wrote in the book Elusive Peace, which we talked about 5 years ago, one thing I've learned in mediating thousands of conflicts and disputes is that when people fight, emotions dominate reason.
That's right.
And in your latest book, you offer a way to diffuse the domination of emotion, to neutralize it enough to allow people to be more rational and negotiate and problem solve.
That's right. And one of the things that I've learned over the years, and as you pointed out in Elusive Peace, is that emotions drive all conflicts. And back in 2012, I was just beginning to develop the tools that finally emerged in my latest book, Deescalate: How to Calm an Angry Person in 90 Seconds or Less. And I was realizing at that time that the first job of anybody, any peacemaker, is to deescalate before you can problem solve. And so I was working on developing tools to help people do that. And at that time, we were just beginning the prison project. And I was testing out these ideas, working with men and women who were serving life sentences. They were mostly murderers, teaching them how to be powerful peacemakers and mediators and how to de-escalate violent situations within prison communities. And the success was so huge. And I had so many inmates coming up to me over the years saying, if I'd had these skills 20 years ago, I wouldn't be in prison today, that I finally decided to write a book for everybody.
Now, why is the title of your book focused on anger? Are there not other emotions that need to be de-escalated?
You can use these skills for any kind of emotion, whether it's positive or negative. I'll go into a Starbucks and I'll look at the person at the register and say, hey, you look really happy today. And they'll just bubble up and light up like a light bulb because I'm validating who they are as a human being. I use anger in the title because that's what most people experience most intensely, is when somebody is angry with them or angry in their life, and people don't know what to do. They freeze up. They become defensive. They become conflict avoidant. Maybe they respond in kind by becoming angry themselves. But it's the anger that seems to trigger the worst in people who are in the presence of anger or the victim of anger. And what I want to do is show people how to respond to that anger quickly, efficiently, and most importantly, effectively, to calm people down, to get into problem solving.
And one of the first steps that you teach people is to ignore the words.
That's correct.
The emotional trigger of verbiage.
That's correct. We are taught that words contain meaning. Words are symbols of meaning and reality, and they are most important. But the truth of the matter is that when people are really emotional, we know what the words are. We know what people are going to say. When you've been cussed out, you don't need to hear people cussing you out for the 10th time to know what those words are. So the trick is to ignore those words. They have no meaning in the moment. It's just hot air.
Why is it so hard for people to ignore the words?
Because they've never been told to ignore the words before. Once I give you permission to ignore the words, it becomes really easy.
Well, a lot of times when somebody's angry with me, they're going to use words that are almost guaranteed to trigger me because maybe it's touching on something I'm insecure about.
That's right. And so I'm giving you, Paul, permission. Just ignore those words. It's meaningless.
Uh-huh.
It does not matter what those words are. Just ignore them.
Why does it seem to matter so much? Is that just our addiction to being right?
Yeah, it's how we've been trained. We've been acculturated to paying attention to the words. And when people are angry with us and use vile words at us, they're basically telling us, I need to be heard right now. And we're responding at a very unconscious level saying, well, how dare you disrespect me this way? And so now we're in the escalation cycle where we can't do anything. But if you ignore the words, you don't get caught up in the escalation cycle. And now you can do something very powerful instead.
And one of the next steps is to identify with the emotional experience of the other person.
That's right. We're just going to guess at what the other person is feeling. And if they're angry, it's pretty obvious.
Mm-hmm.
So all we have to do is guess at what the other person is experiencing. And here's the thing that's really interesting, is that an angry person is not just experiencing anger. An angry person may be experiencing anger, fear, sadness, grief, betrayal, disrespect, being treated unfairly, abandonment, and feeling unloved, all buried under that anger. And what we want to do is kind of guess, well, there's the anger, but what's underneath that stuff?
Would you say that anger is always the most surface, is always...
No.
No,
but it's the one that's the most intense. People could present with sadness or grief.
Right.
That a 14-year-old teenage boy can present with sullenness and unresponsiveness. You know, a 2-year-old in a tantrum can present with rage and frustration. So it could be any kind of intense emotion might present. And what we're really interested in is that not only what is that emotion, but what are all the emotions that are underneath it that are coming up with it?
I think this is largely a book about self-control.
Well, except that if I tell you, Paul, don't react when somebody's angry, you are incapable of doing that. We can't help but react unless somebody teaches us the actual skill necessary not to react. And the skill is to ignore the words and pay attention to the emotions. If you ignore the words and pay attention to the emotions, you will not react.
Right, because it's an idea.
You can't use your mental process to stop how you feel. We don't have control over our emotional reactions to people. We don't have control over it.
Right.
So what we have to do is learn another set of skills by paying attention to something completely different than what we're used to paying attention to. when we do that, we don't become reactive.
You can think of it as kind of intervening with ourselves, because if I say something quickly enough and say, oh, you're pissed off, and that's, you know, you call that affect labeling.
Affect labeling. Mm-hmm.
Central skill of the book, and we're going to get to that in a minute. But if I do that quickly enough, that's going to help me avoid reacting.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. Because you don't have, there's not room in your brain. You don't have the cognitive capacity in your brain, the bandwidth, if you will, to be able to be upset and at the same time pay attention to somebody else's emotions and reflect back what their experience is. We have very limited cognitive capacity. And when you focus on emotions, there is no room for anything else.
You talk about this thing in the book called emotional intelligence or emotional competency.
Right.
Tell us about that.
So emotional intelligence is a phrase that really came from the 1980s from research. Solovey and Myers, I think they were. And Daniel Goleman popularized it in his famous book in the 1990s. But the research shows that people who are emotionally intelligent tend to be much, much more successful in life than those people who have lower levels of emotional intelligence. Emotional intelligence has five parts to it. The first is self-awareness. How aware are you of your own emotional experience moment to moment? Second, can you modulate your emotions in one way or another so that you can deal with the intensity and duration of your emotional experience? Three, do you have impulse control? Can you resist the reactivity that your emotions might be calling you to engage in and do something different? Number four, can you read the emotions of another person? And five, can you create a deep empathic connection at an emotional level with another person? When you use the skills that I teach, you start developing emotional intelligence at the end. So by learning how to read somebody else's emotions, creating an empathic connection by basically affect labeling them. When you do that over a period of time, usually about 2 to 3 weeks, you then develop self-awareness, the ability to modulate, and you develop impulse control. And we have seen this happen time and time and time again with our inmates in prison. It's very, very powerful.
And you teach in the book that we're actually trained to do exactly the opposite, that we're trained to be emotionally incapacitated.
That's correct. We are taught from a very early age that emotions are bad. That's because our Western culture gives privilege to rationality and rational thinking over emotions. This goes all the way back to Plato, and even before Plato, it made its way into Neoplatonism. It made its way into church theology through Augustine and then into the 17th century Enlightenment thinkers. But neuroscience now teaches us that we are 100% emotional. Our rationality is based on emotion, and we have to start recognizing that we are emotional beings first and only have a very limited, bounded rationality. That we are, what distinguishes us from all other species is not our rationality, it's our emotions. No other animal on the planet has the broad range of emotions that we have.
Oh.
No, none of them, not even close. And it's emotions which define humanity, not rationality. And that's the startling discovery of neuroscience that still hasn't made it into our mainstream culture. But if you think about it, it makes perfect sense. And as a mediator and a peacemaker, I deal with emotionality every day. I can't talk to an emotional person using persuasion, logic, or rationality. I have to talk to them at an emotional level. I have to reach out to them at an emotional level. That's the only way I can get them de-escalated to move them into problem solving.
And there's no point trying to do problem solving before you've de-escalated.
That's right. And when I teach people how to mediate, I say it's a two-step process. De-escalate, then problem solve. Our natural instinct is to want to problem solve first and ignore the emotions. And as we all know from practical experience, all that does is make things worse.
You know, when you talk about emotional literacy or emotional intelligence, you point out the fact that if you ask somebody to list all the various emotions that they could think of, they'll come up with a list of 20 or so.
Maybe.
But in general, they're only going to personally refer to 6 or 7.
That's right.
So we're pretty ignorant about our ability, in our ability to be empathic.
That's right. We're very limited because we are not trained in these skills. And what's even worse is that the part of our formal educational system that develops the emotional side of our being is the first thing to be cut. And what's that? It's arts and music and anything having to do with creativity. There's a big emphasis on STEM, which is important. But if you don't teach a four-year-old how to be artistic or how to read good literature or how to engage in art, that kid's going to have a hard time managing emotions, because it's art that leads us through an emotional experience, and it's literature that leads us through an emotional experience. Cutting those things out of our education is like cutting off 98% of our brain.
Right. Now, you point to this skill that you call affect labeling.
Correct.
Which is the fastest way to de-escalate an argument or conflict. So tell us about this technique.
So it's called affect labeling. I think the easier way to conceptualize it is to think about just simply telling somebody what you think they're feeling, using a very simple use statement. So I might say, Paul, you're really angry, Paul. You're really frustrated. You don't feel like anybody's supporting you. You feel like you've been completely betrayed. And you're feeling sad because you're all alone, because you're having to do this all by yourself and there's nobody out there, and you feel like you've been completely abandoned. Notice that I used all these different layers of emotions with simple use statements. I didn't ask a question, and I did not use an I statement. And what the research shows us, the brain scanning studies show, is that when you use use statements and simply label what you think somebody's feeling, the emotional centers of the brain that are contributing a whole bunch of information to the neural network begin to calm down, and the ability to process information, emotional information through the prefrontal cortex, comes back online. It happens automatically every time. Every human being is hardwired for this.
So this is better than just telling me I'm full of it and I'm thinking wrong and I'm forming wrong conclusions and why don't I just get over myself?
Right. So all of those statements are forms of emotional invalidation.
Uh-huh.
And
I've experienced that.
That's right. We all have. And emotional invalidation is the way that is what we do to other people, especially kids, children, in order to soothe our own anxiety around the emotionality of another person, because we haven't been taught how to be present with the strong emotions of another human being. So we tend to emotionally invalidate, but what's really going on is we're saying, go away, I don't want these emotions around me, they make me anxious. What you're really saying is, you're making me anxious, and I don't want you to make me anxious, so stop doing what you're doing.
And I'm going to shame you for it until you stop.
That's right.
It sort of reminds me of the way that parents fling the word selfish around to try to manipulate their kids through shame.
That's right.
You know, and actually using the word selfish is like a very self-centered way to manipulate somebody who's annoying you.
I will argue that it is the most common and most insidious kind of emotional abuse that exists in families today. And we know from the research that this form of emotional abuse happens in many, many families, the vast majority of families this happens in. But we know from the ACEs study that this kind of pervasive long-term emotional invalidation leads to really bad consequences in adult life. It leads to cancer, it leads to cardiac disease, chronic pulmonary disorders, diabetes, obesity, drug addiction, alcoholism, criminal behavior. And you're saying, well, my kid's not going to be that way. Maybe your kid has some resilience, which we still don't understand much about. But let me tell you something. Every person I work with in prison has a horror story to tell about childhood that's unbelievable. And you're saying, well, I don't treat my kids that way. And I said, yeah, true, but how happy are you? And how peaceful is your life? What did you learn from your parents? And the fact of the matter is that we have learned emotional invalidation from our parents because they didn't know any better, and we unconsciously invalidate our children.
Right.
I'm trying to stop that cycle, because it's that cycle that is creating a lot of the problems in our world today.
You make a radical point in your book that most childhood abuse is primarily emotional in nature. And you make the point that over time it's actually more damaging than physical or even sexual abuse.
That's what the ACEs study shows us out of San Diego. And it's absolutely true. And it's more insidious, and it's unconscious, and we're not even aware that we're doing it, because it's what we learned. And we're teaching our children how to be abusive in their relationships. I mean, think about it this way. You take a two-year-old little boy, skins his knees, and your dad, and you say, hey, get over it. Don't be a sissy. Don't be a wussy. You got to tough up. You got to man up. Life is tough. What are you teaching that boy about emotions? You're teaching him that emotions are bad, that he's got to be shut down, and that he can't feel anything. Now, fast forward 13 years, he's 15 years old, he's getting interested in a girl, and he's been shut down emotionally for the last 13 years. What do you think the likelihood of that relationship going anywhere is going to be? It's a train wreck waiting to happen.
Right.
We have shut down our children's emotions. They do not know how to manage their own emotional experience, so that when they get into an intimate relationship as adults, they are complete failures.
Okay, so you point out when we are interested in de-escalation, we really only have to remember six fundamental affects.
That's right.
Even out of these 20 or so human emotions, there's six that we have to remember. Why is that, and what are they?
Well, because the affects, this gets complicated, but affects are a way of describing internal states of our body and brain. The six of them sort of capture the broads. There's an infinite number of different experiences we can have internally, but the six basic affects seem to capture the vast majority of internal experiences as well as can be expected. And it makes it easy. And what I found is that if you just learn these basic words, you are equipped to calm most people down most of the time. You don't need to have a huge vocabulary of emotions in order to get people down. Now, the fact of the matter is, the broader your emotional vocabulary, the better off you're going to be for a whole bunch of different reasons. But for doing this skill, all you need are six words: anger, disrespect, let's say, fear and anxiety, sadness and grief, shame and humiliation, and unlovable and abandoned.
Right.
That's it.
Right.
Everything kind of boils down to those basic ideas. Now, there are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of words in the English language that describe various nuances of those basic concepts. But that's all you really need to get somebody to calm down.
Okay. Now, how do we have a calm conversation with the politically polarized? I mean, this is a problem a lot of us have, even within our own families, particularly since the Trump election and how much more divisive everything has gotten.
Right. So the first thing we have to realize is that the way to political power today is through division, not through coming together. So the way that politicians get elected is by dividing and conquering, polarizing, creating tribes. That's how they get power. That's where their power is coming from. And they have fooled us into thinking that by becoming tribal, we are stronger, when in fact, of course, we're much weaker. So let's suppose that we're having a conversation with somebody who has beliefs that are absolutely repugnant to our own on any issues. I know you live up in Portland and some very open-minded people up there, but let's just suppose that one of your open-minded people in Portland is having a conversation with somebody from Idaho who has maybe very radically different beliefs.
Right.
How do you go about having a conversation with that person? The first thing is your own attitude. You have to be the adult. You can't be looking to be validated yourself, and you certainly cannot be in cross-examination or argumentation mode. You're really not interested in trying to convince the other person of the righteousness of your cause. What you're really trying to do is find out why they think the way they do. So the first question is, Paul, you've got these beliefs that are obviously very important to you. What I'd like to know are, what are all the life experiences that you've had that led you to the beliefs that you have today?
Mm-hmm.
So now we're going to get into a narrative, a storytelling situation where you, Paul, will be telling me about the important life experiences that led you to your beliefs around, say, gun control or the lack of gun control, if that's the issue at hand. And we're going to sit there and talk about your life experiences, and I'm going to find out that we have many shared experiences.
Right.
Then I'm going to ask the next question. Paul, tell me about how your beliefs around freedom and gun control and independence, how do those guide you in your everyday life?
Mm-hmm.
How do they help you navigate your world?
Right. Oh, man, we could talk about this for a long time, but we're pretty rapidly running out of time. And I find that very useful. You know, you point out in the book, Never argue against an emotional belief because logic
That's
and,
right.
because logic and reasoning will not change an emotional mind.
That's right.
And you give counsel on how to relate to people in conversations like we were just talking about. But also you have chapters that focus on children and teens and coworkers and intimate partners. And it's a fabulous resource, this book. My question now, as we come to a close here, is why are you offering your book for free? And tell us about that.
So I have the ability to buy the book on Amazon for anybody who wants the book, as long as people are willing to pay the shipping. And the reason that I'm doing that is because I feel so strongly about the power of what I'm teaching. I have seen this transform thousands of lives that I want to create an army of people who are willing to learn these skills and go out and use them in their communities. I've watched 30 men in a prison completely change the culture of that prison in 1 year using these skills.
Let's tell people how to do that.
So it's really simple. Go to my website, Doug Knoll, DougNoll.com. Click on the banner, go to the order page, pay your $7. You'll also be given an opportunity to buy the online video course with all the workbooks. If you want more in-depth training, that's totally optional on your part. And the book will be coming to you in a couple of days from Amazon. DougKnoll.com. Click on the banner.
Thank you very much for doing that, Doug. And thank you for being on Pathways today. And for those who tuned in late, this is your Pathways host, Paul O'Brien, author of Great Decisions, Perfect Timing, a book that shares the theme of Pathways, which is personal and cultural evolution. In a second, I'll tell you how you can rewind and replay this interview anytime you like via the internet or as a free podcast. Today, we have been visiting with Doug Knoll, author of the book Deescalate: How to Calm an Angry Person in 90 Seconds or Less. I want to say thank you to all of our listeners for tuning into the Pathways program, which is broadcast and streamed worldwide via KBOO.fm Sunday mornings at 8:30 a.m. USA Pacific Time. Podcasts of today's show, which you can listen to and forward to others, are available for free at divination.com, spelled divination.com, as well as via iTunes and other free podcast servers. This is Paul O'Brien reminding you to tell your friends about Pathways Radio and podcasts. And thanks again to Doug Knoll, and to all of you listeners for tuning in and being a part of the Pathways experience.